All right, welcome to America This Week. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Walter Kern.
Walter, you're looking very Billy Jack this week.
And that's on purpose, because there's some marauders coming to town, some marauding hippies, and I'm going to kick their butts.
You got to do those roundhouse kicks. Yeah.
No, it's actually because I'm in Las Vegas, and I'm at America This Week Las Vegas studio. And it's freezing cold, as it always is in desert communities. You think it's going to be warm, and it's not. You don't have the right clothes. So I pulled on a jean jacket, and I thought it might add a little touch of earthiness and populist Elon. Common sense. Yeah, Elon. But, yeah.
Nice. Well, that's an appropriate costume for this week's discussion. We're going to be talking about somebody who is sort of the opposite the new NPR CEO, Catherine Marr, who is what was originally a tangential character, not a tangential, but she was not the main character in a drama involving the NPR senior editor Yuri Berliner, now former. He resigned in the middle of this week, and we talked about that last week and all the problems that that NPR had. And then there's that famous maple cocaine tweet where, you know, about how, you know, everybody is famous on the internet for 5 minutes, and your job is to not be that person. Actually, it's each day on Twitter, there is one main character. The goal is to never be it. And she became the main character of Twitter probably last weekend. And then this progressed into this thing over the middle of this week, in part because Berliner was suspended. And then he was kind of ousted. And before we get to the whole thing about her, I'm just curious about your reaction to how NPR handled the criticism that they got, because it just, having covered all those police brutality stories, it reminded me so much of the way police departments behave when somebody accuses somebody on the force of, you know, a brutality complaint or something like that. There was a blue wall at NPR, and they just attacked him. They defended the integrity of the institution and said it was his fault, and didn't appear to be take any criticism, it seemed to me.
Right. Well, you could say they closed ranks, but their ranks were already a solid ice wall, so they didn't close them any more than they already were. Instead of addressing his criticism, as we went into last week, which was really about the coverage and the content of NPR, they suggested that besides being a traitor and a snitch in some way, he didn't like the composition of the place, or that somehow he was rejecting their diversity requirements and goals, which wasn't the aim of his essay, but in any case,
all, I didn't think.
He was no, he was made into an abominable ingrate and someone who was trying to take down a revered American institution. They got very patriotic about NPR in a way that they're not patriotic about a lot of things, and kicked him out, showing that the in-group is absolutely inviolable and will not be questioned, will not be challenged. I think they're on a course for some kind of, you know, all the people who might boycott them don't listen to them anyway, so that won't happen. The question is whether there's some 5% of listeners who still are, you know, forming their opinions about life and the world, and who might be a little distressed by their closed-mindedness. But in any case, they've gotten rid of the, you know, they've gotten rid of the dissident.
The wrong thinker.
The wrong mm-hmm. thinker. They've demonstrated for all of America what happens to you if you're in one of these institutions and you raise your hand with an objection. And now they'll carry on. They'll carry on under the leadership of this woman who has been now raked over the coals to some extent for many days. Not only was she the object of Twitter fame for one day, she's really been so solidly for almost a week.
Well, but that's only because of a rather unique quality to her situation, which is that normally when somebody gets into a gets stuck in the middle of a Twitter maelstrom, it's because of one thing that they said, and you know, if you don't give the fire oxygen, which is interesting because we're gonna come back to that when we talk about our story today. But if you don't feed the controversy, it doesn't go on for more than a day. The problem with her is that there is this gigantic reservoir of stuff in her tweeting history that became, you know, central to the entire controversy, and there's a gigantic quantity of it. So people haven't even finished going through it, and it's germane to a real controversy because, among other things, when Berliner finally resigned, he said, you know, he referenced these divisive views that I mentioned in my article. They continue to be on display. And, you know, we might as well just give people a little flavor of what that is. I mean, there's a level of this story which is just kind of funny, because she's, mm-hmm. The comparison I made was to the spoof site Titania McGrath. And Walter, do you read that site, by the way?
No. When I first started seeing the comparisons, I thought Titania McGrath was a movie character. Then I saw that she is a Twitter persona, an invented satirical Twitter persona. She does resemble Maher. How do you pronounce her last name?
Maher. Like Bill Maher.
Mm-hmm. Maher. So perfectly that it feels almost like surveillance was done on Maher in order to create the character.
It's true, yeah. So the Titania McGrath is the invention of a sort of a British satirist named Andrew Doyle, and the conceit of the site is that this is a very wealthy white woman who's overeducated, but she's so completely steeped in kind of postmodernist gibberish that. Everything she says is just incredibly funny, and she's clearly got daddy issues. I mean, there's a very funny thing where Catherine Maher actually talked about how Father's Day is difficult for her, complicated for her, which was, I thought, a strange thing to reveal on Twitter. But the Titania McGrath site has a whole thing about how daddy took me to the Veuve Clicquot champagne house and ordered the wrong vintage, and you know, boy, am I upset. And it's the parody version, but just to give a little flavor of the exact comparison here. So here's Catherine Maher talking about her white woman voice. I know that hysteric white woman voice. I was taught to do it. I've done it. It's a disturbing recognition. While I don't recall ever using it to deliberately expose another person to immediate physical harm, on my own cognizance, it's not impossible. That is whiteness. That's kind of awesome, I think, by itself, that tweet. And then here's Titania. I get a lot of hate on Twitter from white women who simply do not understand my pain. try experiencing 400 years of slavery, then we'll talk. And here's Marr on talking about church. LOL at disapproval of the Met Gala, as though Catholicism's history has not been rife with appropriation, excess, performative ostentation, and rigid social hierarchies. Those who are raised Catholic don't at me. And then here's Titania on the Church of England. If God exists, they should sue the Church of England for misgendering them for the past 500 years. Just in the last example I'll just give is, this comes up actually kind of repeatedly in both their accounts, this whole idea that when people are being generous or charitable, they actually have some kind of other motive. This person, Tom Gara, points out that Noam Chomsky is in that heroic category of people, along with Mark Cuban, who respond to every email. There should be a word for them. And he listed a whole bunch of Noam's emails. And she wrote, "Man, if women wrote such abbreviated emails, they'd be considered terribly rude." This came up a lot. Titania's version was, "Men will often conceal their misogyny by being nice. So if you have a male friend who's never hit you, spat in your face, or called you a whore, he's almost certainly a misogynist." Anyway, I don't want to make too much of the jokiness aspect, but let's just say she's very on the nose in terms of the caricature, so much so that it's hard not to wonder about it at times. It seems like almost like a performance, doesn't it?
But it wasn't. There's no reason to believe that it was a performance. It was a sincere exposition of self. And it happens that that self appears to be entirely formed by lectures, TED Talks, textbooks, and very insular conversations with people just like herself, because her English, if I'm to analyze it as a literary critic, shows no sign of personality. It is a true melange or collage of buzzwords, received attitudes, and nostrums and maxims from a kind of academic leftism that you expect to see on campus, but don't expect to see people seriously espousing as their own thinking. But her own thinking is an interesting construct for me because, as I say, it does not appear to come from a human individual, but from a kind of party pamphlet filtered through a person who's having all the same problems personally that we're having socially. In other words, whiteness, for example, seems to be something that she's thinking about every day in almost every interaction. Patriarchy seems to weigh heavily on her, even while having coffee. She doesn't have the same problems that you and I have. And I think she represents what happens and what will happen once we no longer have free speech, once everything is a sort of canned recitation of reverential, pre-approved political statements. I was telling you before the show, there's a kind of a conspiracy theory, a mock conspiracy theory, that she's not indeed a biological being, but an AI construct. And the reason that that's so funny is that it again appears that Gemini AI might be responsible for all her pronouncements.
Right, yeah. Did you ever read Walter Flaubert wrote a Dictionary of Received Ideas, or a Dictionary of Received Wisdom? I forget how it's translated.
Right, yeah, he did. I mean, she is the 2024 version of received ideas masquerading as the thoughts of an individual. But she's kind of a post-individual, even in her TED Talks and some of the clips that have been circulated. She doesn't believe in truth and yet believes she has it. She, remember, worked at Wikipedia, which is a, or she was responsible for the company that
Wikipedia. She was CEO of Wikimedia. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she holds out the Wikipedia model as a new information hygiene protocol, where everybody kind of adds to the pile, and especially what they call high integrity sources get preference. And you come up with this kind of communal info product that is not the work of any one person and represents the kind of best of received wisdom on any topic. And that she has raised to a philosophical standard. Like I say, it's easy to fall into the kind of gender-based satire as far as her person and her persona. But I think more important than that is that she is a kind of walking Wikipedia herself. Everything seems to have been installed by some super user, and she's downranked her most personal or eccentric thoughts. She doesn't seem to have any eccentric thoughts, and upranked everything that would be agreed to readily in a conversation on, the Harvard campus.
So that's a really interesting way to frame it, because in addition to the fact that when she's at leisure, she doesn't seem to have, most of her Twitter timeline is just a sort of an endless compendium of banal observations. Whenever she enters any space, she always counts the number of minorities and women, and then she tweets about that. There's one very funny tweet where she's just sitting around doing nothing and says it's a day like any other except for the metric fuck ton of misogyny. So this is like going through her mind even without any stimuli. But what you just mentioned, this whole idea of not really having any individual conviction apart from what everybody thinks. Now, this is a very important concept at Wikipedia. And there was something that happened at Wikipedia that was a kind of a radical and very important change in how we view information in this country, which is the Wikipedia started off as an independently edited sort of encyclopedia service where everybody was allowed to participate, and then it became a fiercely regimented sourcing mechanism that dramatically narrowed the field of what you can see. And it's funny, if you go back and look, her early statements are very much sort of traditional pro-free speech, First Amendment kind of stuff, although she doesn't specifically mention the First Amendment, but pre like 2014, her attitudes seem a little bit like yours or mine. And then there is this change. Now, I want to just play a clip of an interview that she did with Brandi Zadrozny of NBC, but here it's in the form of a discussion at the Atlantic Council. And here she describes the transformation of Wikipedia. And this is worth checking out.
And Wikipedia was, has the spirit of the open internet, of the beginning of the promise of the internet, where everybody is invited, even if it's not always the most welcoming platform, as you have been working on in the last couple of years. And we'll talk about that too. I want to frame things with the frame of rights for a second, because I think we hear a lot about freedom and rights right now. And particularly that debate has been framed, at least in the States and in Western countries, around the freedom of speech, right? And expression online. It revolves around whether moderation of speech or algorithmic amplification or quieting violates a person's freedom. And Wikipedia isn't immune to that debate, right? In its own ways, it amplifies voices and points of view at the exclusion of others. So what are your thoughts about this current fight that's been the subject of congressional hearings and Facebook Oversight Board decisions? How are you thinking these days about the concept of freedom online?
Yeah, it is a very complicated conversation, certainly more so than we started having it maybe 15, 20 years ago.
So just to pause for a moment, it's going to, and this is characteristic of the way she talks, it's going to take a second before she hits the scary thing that she says. But when she gets there, and when she starts talking about structures of governance, she's actually saying something quite meaningful after a bunch of, you know, sort of platitudes, and just pay close attention.
I think that what we look at with Wikipedia is that it is a very different platform. It is a purpose-driven platform rather than an expression platform. I think as we look at social media broadly, the solution sets around how we address questions of governance, questions of content integrity, questions of anti-harassment, for example, are really going to be need to be tailored to the purpose of those platforms. One of the things that I think is useful is to see sort of how we are transitioning from a conversation around how do we just simply transpose this idea that online rights are human rights. You know, there's no distinction. I think this was very much the sort of Clinton State Department understanding of rights in the digital space, to an understanding that actually we've never really thought about rights at the scale of a network of 3 billion people and what our norms and expectations are and whether traditional structures of governance can really meet this moment. The platforms that I'm having a conversation with are really looking at what might we need to do to fundamentally rethink the concept of sort of governance at scale that is representative in a way that sort of suits the needs of the platforms while also respecting rights in a way that doesn't, that isn't impractical to be.
So you caught that shift, right? Zadrozny's asking, Wikipedia was this open, the symbol of the open internet. And she says, well, we're making this shift to reimagining, rethinking rights and wondering if rights really can work at scale. And
there you see the trick, Matt. These rights of ours were convenient and affordable when we lived in small towns, states, cities, and countries. But at scale, now that we're thinking about the global mind, they're no longer practical. We can no longer afford them. We have to question them. And the thing that has changed is numbers. Somehow, the numbers of people in the world, you mentioned 3 billion, don't afford us the same latitude that smaller numbers do. Now, I don't know what the logic of that is. I don't know why quantity should affect quality with information and why structures of governance and so on should necessarily change. But she is a wiki person, okay? She has a wiki mind. She is devoted to the notion that that, as she said in other settings, there is no particular truth. There is only this agglomeration of beliefs, views, and trusted sources. And this is how things will run now. So we're post-rights, we're post-constitutional civil liberties, and we're now in some sort of strange, giant hive mind that has to run by new rules. I will note that in her verbiage, she always defaults to the biggest word and the fuzziest word, because honestly, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She could not explain it to a fourth grader. I completely find a lapse in logic between saying, you know, freedom's great for you and I and, you know, small groups, but at scale, we can't afford it. Why? The way she speaks is hypnotic and lilting and very sure of itself, pretending that everything is self-evident, but she proves nothing. So it's really just a form of hypnotic suggestion as far as I'm concerned. I got no tangible argument from that.
Yeah, and okay, she gave a TED talk, that's been circulating, but and she talks about exactly what you're describing here, and she tries to elucidate what she means when she talks about things like truth. And I think it's kind of interesting. Let's have a listen about, you know, the conception about the difference between being sort of truth-based and focusing on something else.
But the people who write these articles, they're not focused on the truth. They're focused on something else, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years of working with these brilliant folks, I've come to believe that they are onto something, that perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. Now, that is not to say that the truth doesn't exist, nor is it to say that the truth isn't important. Clearly, the search for the truth has led us to do great things, to learn great things. But I think if I were to really ask you to think about this, one of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world.
Okay, so she goes on from there to say
that's that the most self-canceling argument than, I've ever heard. I mean, it's completely self-canceling. Yeah. I mean, so there's no truth. Beliefs and facts somehow need to be merged, but we're gonna rule out certain beliefs and prefer certain ones over others. In other words, the problem with this kind of relativism is that she's suggesting we can only do our best. We can only sort of pool our best guesses. And rather than there being a final truth, we have to be satisfied with that. But then she also suggests that certain beliefs and certain best guesses and so on should be downranked versus others. She gave this speech before she was at NPR. But when there's no bottom line, what you've got is just a kind of argument by authority. Whoever is most authoritative and highest, most highly esteemed at the moment gets to speak. They put their idea with others who of similar authority, and then we get this glob of semi-truth. Well, then let's just have a free-for-all. But now she's in a position at NPR and was when at Wikipedia where you're trying to do something better than just fuse people's beliefs. And so it goes around and around and around. And what she's finally saying is, it's what I say it is. I mean, it's really Animal Farm. It's some truths are more equal than, there is no truth, but some truths exactly. are more equal than others.
Right. So she comes around sort of to this numerical argument eventually, which is that each one of us has, we all have our own truths. The person sitting next to you, that person has his or her own truth. But we can't, we don't have space for all these truths. So we are going to find, we're going to settle on the sort of minimum truth that most people can agree with. And that is going to be our definition.
And she talks about the search for common ground as though that's the acme